Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up later, we'll talk to the first ever poet in residence in the city of Eau Claire.
First, the Tama Veterans Affairs Medical Center has been under scrutiny since a former Marine died there from a drug overdose in 2014. Last Friday, the federal government finally reached a $2.3 million settlement with the family of Jason Simkuski.
Simkuski was 35 when he died at the short-stay mental health recovery unit at the VA's Community Living Center. His death led to the firing of the chief of staff, and the former head of the center also resigned earlier this month.
Hope Kerwin is a reporter based in La Crosse for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She is joining us now to share the latest. Hope, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So Hope, give us the details of this settlement. What does the document really say about the purpose of, you know, what the settlement was?
So at this point, the settlement hasn't been approved, but it's kind of a tentative agreement between the federal government and the Simkuski family. Basically, the U.S. government is agreeing to pay Heather Simkuski and her daughter $2.3 million, but it is not an admission of liability or fault, and it says that explicitly. So basically, it's not the federal government saying it had a part in Simkuski's death, but it is agreeing to pay this settlement.
So without the admission of guilt, it kind of sounds as though the government is safeguarding itself from maybe future issues, maybe even coming out of the Tama VA facility. It has not had the best PR as of late. And you mentioned members of Simkuski's family. What has been their role in, you know, suing the government over this issue with Jason Simkuski?
So it's my understanding, after talking with their attorney, that initially they had tried to kind of file for a settlement through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And when that was unsuccessful, they filed this wrongful death lawsuit against the U.S. government last August. So this is kind of, it's been drawn out over a number of years at this point. But they're hoping that this settlement will kind of be the end of this legal battle.
And $2.3 million sounds like a lot. Obviously, the settlement is in a pretty preliminary phase right now. But how will that money, I guess, either make it to the family or go to attorneys?
Well, it's my understanding that $586,000 might go to attorney fees, up to that amount, with over, about $659,000 potentially going directly to Heather Simkuski and her daughter up front. That's basically kind of all we know at this point.
Sure. It's still in the early stages. Obviously, more will probably change as time moves forward. And this has been an issue that has been looked into for quite a long time at this point. When exactly did the Inspector General start looking into this issue?
It was not immediately after Simkuski's death, but I believe the report came out in 2015 about some wrongdoings at the facility, and from there it's kind of been a snowball effect of different issues at the Tama VA.
We're talking right now to Hope Kerwin. She is a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. We're talking about a settlement that has come about after out of a wrongful death lawsuit involving a Marine who died while at the Tama VA facility. Simkuski was honorably discharged from the Marines in 2002. What do we know about what he was being treated for at the VA?
I know that he was being treated through the psychiatric unit for a variety of conditions, and that was part of what played into his death, was that he was on a number of medications. His official cause of death was from mixed drug toxicity, and so because of the just the different amounts of medications, that's actually what has been found that led to his death.
And, did his family have grievances with, insofar as you know, with the VA before they filed the lawsuit? How did they get from, Jason Simkuski's death to you know, eventually saying, we're going to take you to court over this?
Well, I mean, the Simkuski family has been very involved in the different kinds of, you know, reforms or measures to look into the Thoma VA and its practices. You know, they have really been involved in a number of federal pieces of legislation, state legislation, and just kind of being a part of these reforms and active in kind of looking at those practices and what changes need to be made.
Now, the lawsuit did lead to several departures from the VA facility. What key people ended up leaving?
Well, obviously, the medical director of the Thoma VA was left, and also the chief of staff, Dr. David Houlihan. You know, there has also been, over the years, have been some proceedings where he had over his medical license and the future of him being able to practice. So those are Dr. David Houlihan, the chief of staff, but also the head of the medical center, Mario De Sanctis, were the biggest people to leave.
So there's been a lot of conversation about the Veterans Affairs Facility at Thoma. It was called Candyland, derisively, obviously, because of the amount of opioids being prescribed, the drugs being prescribed to the people seeking care there. You know, how does, you know, this really affect now with this lawsuit settlement, obviously preliminary, how does this affect the Thoma VA in the community as it is now?
Well, the Thoma VA has done a lot of work over the last few years to kind of address these issues and, you know, trying to show the community that they are working to improve what they're doing. And so, you know, they have new leadership in place and have, you know, they've been very vocal to say, look, we had these problems in the past and this is what we're doing about them. And even as far as taking measures to create an environment where employees who see wrongdoing or potential wrongdoing feel more comfortable, you know, kind of blowing the whistle on those issues potentially. So, you know, I think that one that is definitely something that has come out of this death is at least on from what the VA is reporting, they've been trying to work on these issues.
Well, thanks, Hope. We will obviously check back in with you as this story progresses. Hope Kerwin is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter based in La Crosse. She joined us for the latest news on the Thoma VA Medical Center. On Friday, the federal government reached a settlement with the family of former Marine Jason Simkuski. He died from a drug overdose at the facility. Right now, one of Wisconsin's most powerful voices in the world of poetry is back with us. After winning the Brittingham Prize in Poetry earlier this year, former Wisconsin Poet Laureate Max Garland is back with a brand new collection of poems, some of which he's going to share with us today.
In addition to being a former Poet Laureate of Wisconsin, he's also a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and is the first writer in residence for the city of Eau Claire. His new book of poems is called The Word We Used For It. Max, welcome back.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, Max, let's start with the title of your new book, your collection, The Word We Use For It. So there's a lot going on in that title. You're thinking about language and playing with language and also getting into the symbolism of what words stand for. How would you describe what that title is about?
I think it's an old theme in poetry that the word we use for the things we're talking about often is not the word we wish for, and sometimes not the sufficient word to express or hold the feeling or image. And yet we fling words out there trying to contain those things. And so I think that's that interesting tension between how hard it is to convey experience and emotion and how much we continue to try, and that strong need to try it. And so it's always sort of just the word we use for it, not the perfect word.
Do you feel like as a poet that imprecision of words, is it something that can be a blessing or is it always a curse?
It gives you a lot of latitude, certainly. It gives you a large task, but I think it's not just a poetic challenge. I think we do this. People do it every day. They search for the right word. They try to express something, and they know they don't quite hit it. So I think a poet's task is simply an extension of an ordinary human task, is how hard it is sometimes to say what we mean.
If you had to describe it, how would you describe what this new collection is about? What are the themes that run through it?
That's one theme. Another theme is also an ancient. I don't think I've invented many new themes or any, but I think the other theme is the slipperiness of memory and sort of a confession that memory always is, by and large, partially made of imagination or fueled by imagination. And I think the longer I live, the more I'm okay with the fact that we're not going to find a perfectly intact file with a memory in it, but we're going to have to work on that memory with our imagination, shaping it. In fact, I almost feel like our memories aren't, in a sense, our lifelong poem in progress.
Hmm. And you are the first ever poet in residence for the city of Eau Claire. What does that job mean to you?
You have to show up a lot. Yeah, my job is to promote poetry, and the arts, and sort of invite people into the process. I have a series of open mics where people are invited to come and say what they want to say. The next one, I think, is here in Eau Claire, and it's based on a phrase by Henry David Thoreau, where I lived and what I lived for. And so that's a sort of typical theme. I'm asking people to come to the open mic and comment upon where they live and what they live for. I mean, that's a pretty broad theme. It's our version of Poet Laureate. It's called Writer in Residence because it's in the future will be open to prose writers and other kinds of writers as well.
There's a lot of the evocation of landscapes in your work. There's a lot of snow. There's a lot of wildlife. There are birds. The squirrel features prominently. Do you feel that you're also writing Wisconsin in the sense that you've experienced it firsthand and you know what the sky looks like on a particular day and what the squirrel on your deck is doing? How does Wisconsin figure into all of it?
There's much more snow than in previous books. The longer my life outside of Kentucky, where I grew up, I think the more snow comes into the poems, the more cold. I think I'm getting more confidence about writing about this place. You know, I lived in a very different place for a long time. But I think I've, you know, as the decades sort of mount up, I feel like I can now speak a little bit more about, you know, this environment. I've traveled over it a lot. Here today in Wisconsin, something is falling. I don't know if it's snow or sleet. It might be that thing we call wintry mix, which is like a beautiful phrase, isn't
right,
it? But it's never a beautiful thing.
Not when you're on the road, for sure.
No.
Maybe inside by the fire. Well, I want to hear your poems before we go any further, and you prepared a couple of them for us. And the first one I'd like to see if you would read for us is called Joy.
Joy, yes. This poem, it's interesting you asked me about that one. I think I was listening to Wisconsin Public Radio when I heard it was 10 below, and I went online to see what the wind chill was, and online I saw temperature 10 below feels like 10 below. And I thought, well, that doesn't tell me much. So I thought I would go outside. I was going to go out, stand under this pine tree next to my house, and I was going to see, like I was going to, I was going to complete the weather report by seeing exactly what 10 below feels like, which, you know, what does it feel like? So that was my job. However, when I worked on the poem, it went somewhere else. A word popped up that I didn't expect. So here's the poem. And I know 10 below by Wisconsin standards is not that drastic, but if you grew up in Kentucky, it's still worth noting. Joy. Just to know how it felt, I stood under the red pine. It was 10 below and the sun was not quite up and the moon not quite down. And the air so cold, you couldn't call it cold anymore, but sort of comical on the intake. And the lungs were like, are you serious? The three-pronged tracks in the snow belong to creatures no longer of this earth. The paw prints, as well, were the only traces of what we once called rabbits when such things bounded from the shrubberies. And the light, which began to climb over the rim of horizon, appeared stunned, like ancestors in old photographs seem stunned. You look at them in their suspenders and bonnets and the austerity of their faces, as if they knew, even then, in the minutes wait for the shutter to close, they were goners. As if they knew the reason for the picture was time without pity. So, I stood under the red pine, took a few more breaths from deep in the glacial instant of my one and only life, which hurt a little, like joy, by which I mean the edge of joy, where it sharpens itself for the work it has to do.
Wow, I love that. It really captures winter and what it feels like to freeze, like the weather, or freeze a moment of time and know that it is this special moment that's never going to repeat itself.
That's an interesting. I didn't think of it that way, but that's very interesting. I also, the thing that surprised me about the poem is I used to think that when we solved all of our personal problems and all of our world's problems, then happiness and would ensue. You know, that was the process. And by the end of this poem, something came up sort of telling me to reverse the process. Maybe it's not that joy happens once we solve the world's dilemmas, but maybe joy is one of the vehicles for solving them.
Hmm. You have a lot about light. It seems like light is a muse for you in this poetry collection, starting with the very first poem, which is you taking in a religious piece of art, and you see the light hitting the face of the young woman who's in the picture. And I wonder, and I saw that come back again and again. What were you thinking about when you thought of all these different ways light interface with your work?
Well, you know, in Wisconsin, during many months, light is not overly abundant, so it's valuable. It's just interesting to me. I think if there's any difference in these poems, it's that there is more intimacy with the Wisconsin environment. There's a little more science. And I intended that poem to be about a particular painting in a museum, but it wound up being about the light, the way it struck the painting, and the cells of the retina that were, you know, activating that life and transmitting them into thoughts. And so the process itself became really interesting. And I don't know. I guess I'm more audacious or less shy about bungling into science in poems than I used to be. I mean, it takes something like 10,000 years for a photon that forms in the center of the sun to kind of pinball its way up to the sun's corona, then 8.5 minutes for it to get here and strike. And so, I think that the wildness of that concept, how long it took the light to illuminate, you know, a stroke of paint, you know, 400 years old, you know, is a sort of source of wonder to me.
We're talking to Max Garland now, former poet laureate of Wisconsin. His new book of poems is called The Word We Used For It. And a lot of it, as we're talking about, is these deep sort of ideas that you can mull over and reveal new things. But some of it is just fun. You've got a funny poem about, it's called Search Committee, which I assume is kind of interview committee. Tell us about where that one came from.
It came from being marched in front of a bunch of search committees to try to get a job. And it came from then sitting on the other side of the table and watching the sort of, in a sophisticated manner, the sort of humiliation of being in front of a search committee in your brand new black coat and necktie, which you never wear, and ill-fitting shoes, and and trying to present yourself in a way that you will be picked for the dubious honor of an academic career.
And towards the end of that poem, there's a line. It's a string of questions, question after question, and then comes the line, "You'll be hearing from someone soon about something."
Exactly.
Which sums it up.
Is a pretty much the kind of vague hope you're often given when putting in front of a search committee, which oddly enough, no one wants to serve on and no one wants to come up in front of.
And Max, you've got some events coming up. Where can people see you and hear more about your poetry in the next coming month or two?
I'll be this weekend at the Driftless Writing Center in Viroqua, I believe on Friday, November 10th at the Volume 1 Gallery here in Eau Claire, November 18th, the Arts and Lit Lab in Madison, and that's all I can remember at the moment.
Sounds good. Well, Max, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your poetry today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Max Garland is a former poet laureate of Wisconsin, a professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, and he's the first writer in residence for the city of Eau Claire. His new book of poems that we've been talking about is called The Word We Used For It. First, decluttering and organizing have become a hot topic of conversation in recent years. People like decluttering expert Marie Kondo have encouraged people to part with their items in order to have a more simplified home and, by extension, a more simplified life. But a new decluttering philosophy making the rounds tries to simplify our death.
It's known as Swedish death cleaning, and a book on the topic is coming out early next year. And it isn't as dire as it might seem at first glance, and it really comes down to downsizing possessions in order to make it easier on loved ones when you ultimately pass away.
Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi is an attorney who focuses on estate planning and probate. Her book is called Middle Class Philanthropists: How Anyone Can Leave a Legacy, and she also writes a blog about frugality. Melinda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me here.
Tell us, what exactly is Swedish death cleaning?
Well, I haven't read the book yet because the American version doesn't come out until January. But from the articles I've read, the concept is for a person to go through their possessions and start disposing of them before their time of passing. And the book seems to focus on those who are in their 70s or 80s. And my take on that is this is really something anyone can do. I've done estate planning for my 12th year of practice, and I know that death does not just reserve itself for those in their 80s. It could happen at any time. And the last thing we want to do is leave a huge mess for people who are cleaning things up. I'd also say that one of the top three reasons people contact me to do an estate plan is that they've received a stage 4 cancer diagnosis. And they know the end is coming. And let's not put this off until we know that finality is there. Let's go with that minimalist movement that's out there and clear clutter on a more regular basis and not wait until we're 80s and certainly not leave it for the next generation to have to clean up.
So this is something that caught your interest. I think it caught a lot of people's interest because it does fall into this, you know, one, it's a little bit of a shocking thing to kind of hear, Swedish death cleaning. But really, it does come at a time when people are considering decluttering in general. So what was appealing to you about it when you first saw it?
Well, I think it's an appealing thing because just from a person who likes to live frugally, I don't want to have to own space to store lots of stuff. So the less that I own, the less space I have to have. It makes cleaning easier, things of that nature. From a professional perspective, people often say their goal is to make things as easy as possible on the loved ones they leave behind. And how can they do that? And they tend to spend a lot of time focusing on, should they have a will? Should they have a trust? And to me, it boils down to a few things. It's being as organized as possible, and also who you leave to be in charge. When you look at it from the organized as possible, it's not just having your paperwork in order, but if you have files of your bank records dating back to the 1960s, if you have all of the books that you use to get your degree program, if you have your photographs plus those that you inherited from your parents and grandparents, you're leaving that to someone else to have to go through. That takes time. It takes a lot of time, and it's an emotional procedure for people to go through. I've lost both of my parents, and I've had the experience of literally cleaning out their ranch home because I had my own, and I couldn't absorb all of that into my house. So from a professional perspective, for those who've done an estate plan or want to do one and they want to be organized, don't just focus on the legal paperwork. Focus on the tangible stuff that's there that someone's going to have to deal with.
That's one of the things I think that's interesting about this. If you look at the the minimalism and the Marie Kondo approach, you're kind of doing it for yourself. So your life is more streamlined and simple. This is kind of your gift to the people in your life. It's, in a way, it's for somebody else. Even while it's peace of mind for you, it seems like the largest gift is for somebody else. Do you think that's part of what appeals?
I do. I think that's the large appeal, because people don't want their departure to be any more difficult than it has to be. And when you use the word gift, I think this is a great way to actually give some very creative gifts. When I started reading some of the materials that you'd sent to me for this interview, it made me remember that when I graduated from law school, one of the gifts my mother gave me was a photograph of me on my first day of kindergarten. You know, had that photo been in a pile of photographs or something like that, it may not have meant as much, but she had the photo, she saved it, she had it framed and gave it to me as a gift. And it was very much bookending from the first day of school to my last day of school. And I still have that photograph today, and I have it in a prominent place. And so it was a gift to me. She worked on culling down her photographs and also turned it into a tangible gift.
Do you think that Swedish death cleaning may ultimately be more approachable because there's a little bit more of a goal, a more tangible goal, versus, say, the Marie Kondo method, where you interact with each of your objects, you get rid of them if they don't spark joy, you hold on to them if they do? It feels a little bit more abstract. Do you think that ultimately it might be, if not easier, I'm trying to think of the best way to phrase this, but I guess easier to attain.
Yes, I do. I think the other approach, I know I heard about the book. I have not read it myself, but several people in my book group have. So I've heard about it through them. And the part for me that was unattainable was the folding, that there was a certain way to have to fold things. I think that's much more of a concept car type of concept. It sounds great, but in practice, it's hard to implement. Whereas this, I think it's, you can do it. You can do it to whatever degree you possibly can or that meets your needs. I think anything you can do now to sort through those possessions, to pass them on, to make your life easier, will inevitably make it easier for other people. It's just a question of degree.
We're talking right now to Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi, an attorney who focuses on estate planning, and she's with us to talk about a new concept called Swedish death cleaning from Sweden, which advises people to downsize their stuff, to go through it, to organize it, to help their loved ones after they're gone, so that their loved ones don't have to be the ones sifting through a lifetime worth of accumulated stuff. And Melinda, how can we start? What do you advise?
Well, I think the first thing to do would be to ask, does anyone else want this? Once you've determined that you're ready to give things away, is to find out. If you have children in your life, and not everyone does, if you have children, find out if three of them all want one painting that grandpa had done, because then you can identify them if there might be a family squabble over who gets that one painting. You can also identify the things that they don't want. There's been a lot written about how, you know, we have the baby boomers who've acquired lots and lots of stuff, and then we have the Gen Xers, which I belong to, and the millennials, who don't want stuff. And you have a generation of people who want to pass their stuff on to people who don't want it. And if they don't want it, then you can be very purposeful. You can take the time to figure out, how can this be recycled or repurposed or donated? You could have a garage sale in which you just ask for donations, identify the items you don't want, put them out for sale, and give the donations to a favorite charity. I remember in 2008, when I was expecting my first child, I bought my baby monitor from a garage sale that supported breast cancer research. So identify what you don't want and then start thinking strategically about how to get rid of it. I think if you know you're passing something on and it has a purpose, I think it's easier to pass it along than to just chuck it. And for those who are environmentally conscious, it's a great way to make sure this doesn't end up in a dumpster, because when someone does pass, things have to happen relatively quickly. If you have a person who is renting, that rent will continue until the apartment's vacated. And if that happens, we sometimes have relatives who come in from out of state, they're here for a weekend, there's a dumpster, and it just all goes in the dumpster. And it can just make one sick to their stomach that so much stuff that could have gone to use to someone in need doesn't, because there's just not the time to reallocate it.
It does feel as though there is a right outside of the immediate family unit, a ripple effect that can happen with the ecological impact, that if you need to throw away this stuff relatively quickly after someone passes away. I mean, do you think that that's something to get into people's heads in order to approach this a little bit better?
Oh, yes. I say this is a great way to be creative. in my situation, there had been a family suit that ironically came from Sweden. It was my great-grandfather's wedding suit. And I had that donated to the Swedish American Museum in Chicago. It was the full top hat, the suit, everything. They're using it for research and for display. And instead of being shoved in the back of someone's closet generation after generation, I was able to put it to better use, I think. So a person can be creative in that way. And even for like the little things that come into your life, I have small children, elementary age, and there's constant inflow of little things that are just going to clutter up our house. I have a box that my kids are probably listening, but I toss things into that I know they don't need. And I give it to a friend of mine who owns a preschool. And then they can use that ribbon or something that I can't recycle, something that really can't be, you know, taken care of easily, they repurpose it. So think about preschools, school art programs, libraries, clothing that maybe a high school theater program could use for costumes. And when you do this now and you're not rushed, you can be much more intentional about it and hopefully see it get a second, third life.
If you think about this as, in a way, preparing for your death, does that make it harder? Because you know, nobody likes to think about death. I mean, it's not fun unless you're doing some kind of religious or contemplative practice where that's the point of the exercise. Otherwise, it's kind of a gloomy prospect. Do you think that makes people less likely to do it?
I do. It is gloomy, but it's something that we all have to face. I mean, we're all going to die at some point. And when I talk about educational seminars that I do, I always say I focus on one issue, and that's taking control of the situation. So if you're looking for something to motivate you, focus on control. Someone is going to make the decision about what to do with your photographs, with your shoes, with your books from college. You can decide that, or you can leave it to someone else. And generally, you are the person who's best equipped to make those decisions. So take control, you know, and then do something fun afterwards.
Treat yourself afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Open up good. A bottle of wine while you do the process.
Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi stays with us. She's an attorney who focuses on estate planning. And we're talking right now about Swedish death cleaning. This is this new concept we're hearing about from Sweden. It will be published in a book in January. The idea to advise people to get rid of their stuff now, to go through it, to organize it, to help loved ones after you're gone.
And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. In listening to our conversation, what are some of the thoughts that you have on this decluttering philosophy? You know, maybe you're a child worrying about this with your parents, or maybe you're a parent or grandparent thinking about this and your loved ones. Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll pick up our conversation in a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're talking about Swedish death cleaning and decluttering in general with Melinda Gustafson-Gervasi. She's a lawyer who specializes in estate planning. She's also a writer who looks a lot at social issues like frugality and minimalism.
And you can join the conversation right now by calling 800-642-1234. What are some of your thoughts on decluttering? Maybe you have some questions on decluttering. Maybe you have some thoughts on Swedish death cleaning in particular. You can give us a call right now at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email at the Ideas Network. That's ideasnetwork@wpr.org.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Paige joining us in Madison. Paige, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I recently read an article on that, and it was timely for me. We had just finished helping my in-laws pack up all of their belongings in preparation for move to an assisted living center. I was amazed at the amount of stuff that they had. Also have a parents that will be moving, and I have, you know, looking forward to, or maybe not, packing all of their belongings. I came home from my in-law's house thinking, I want to get rid of half of what I have, but not only for my daughter, but for me, you know, I almost looked at it as, why wait until I'm in my 60s? I could do this for myself now. And, you know, almost instead of remodeling my house right before I'm going to sell it and let the buyers enjoy it, why don't I declutter my life and I get to enjoy it now?
Ah, Yeah, so have you made any headway with it since your inspiration?
Well, this has only been the last 2 weeks, but we did take a load to Goodwill, and you know, part of it is getting your own family on the same wavelength that you are on, but I hope to make the change and then get to enjoy it now.
Paige, thanks so much for sharing that. I think a lot of us have had that experience after we've had to help a family member with their belongings, a lot of stuff, and it's a lot of emotional weight, too, a lot of emotional labor that can go into that. And Melinda, do you think that that can be a good time to start it, get everyone on the same page, which can be tough, as Paige said, and then just start?
I agree. It can be hard, but I think make a game out of it in a way. Our family did something that I blogged about in 2015. We made it a goal to purge 2015 items in 2015. That was rather ambitious.
It's a lot of stuff.
It was a lot of stuff, but it was kind of a game. We're kind of competitive. What could we do? What, you know, how could we keep up with that? But maybe set a goal that every month you're going to get rid of 10 items, or once a week you're going to do something. We are approaching the new year when people make a lot of resolutions. And I agree that cleaning your house and enjoying your house is a wonderful gift to yourself. I know personally a lot of people are saying, oh, get a house cleaner, things like that. And I think, why bother? I'd have to spend all of that time with getting the clutter removed first. And so my thought is, if I can declutter my house, it's easier to clean my house. And I think a lot of people who work would agree with that.
And we're going to go to our callers again. Jennifer in Waukesha. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
And what did you want to talk about, Jennifer?
Kind of in line with what your first caller, Paige, was saying. I was about 13 or 14 when my grandfather passed away, and I remember helping my parents go through, you know, his whole house. And, I mean, he had an attic full of some miscellaneous, you know, newspaper articles, magazines, trinkets and knickknacks. And also before he passed away, he was a lifelong roommate with his older sister, and a lot of her stuff was left over from when she passed away as well. So we just remember going through all of that. And my dad passed away in 2005, and my mom, who's now just about 80, she is talking about the whole reduction of clutter and things, and she's calling us, her kids, and saying, you know, is there anything you'd like? Come and get it now. And, you know, my mom's feel on that is just she doesn't want us to have to repeat, you know, any portion of that experience that we had cleaning out my grandfather's house. And she just feels that she doesn't want to be a burden to anybody at any point in her life, even after she's gone.
Jennifer, thank you so much for that call. So, you know, Jennifer was talking about seeing this with multiple family members, seeing, you know, grandfather, older aunt as well, you know, with a lot of things. And I do think that there is something also a little bit, there's a generational shift happening as well. I mean, I remember my grandmother holding on to everything because she grew up during the Depression. She didn't want anything to, you know, everything had a purpose, and she had a lot of it. You know, do you think that that is kind of playing a role in the conversation we're having now?
Definitely. There's the Depression era, who kept every piece of string and extra nail because you never knew if they were going to need it. And then there's the baby boomers, who were sort of the first generation with that prosperity to get things, to get stuff, and it really meant something to them to have those collectible dolls, for example. But then you get down to my generation, and it's the plastic generation, and we're inundated with stuff. It's so inexpensive. And I think you see people my age and younger who are more focused on gathering experiences than stuff. So it's definitely something that's there, and it can be a difficult issue because you don't want to hurt the feelings of your elders and your family, what's something that's very special to them, and you don't want that. So some people will do something where they take it, and then when that person's gone, they pass it on. But others of the older generations understand they don't want this item, or it's just not practical. The days where you move out and you live 3 miles from your parents are gone. I have friends, you know, who relocated to Beijing, or Shanghai, I should say. People live all around the globe, and it's not practical to relocate the family piano from, you know, 1 to 2,000 miles away. So accepting that reality is important to do.
We're definitely in an era, I think, where this is a trend to declutter. And it's almost like there's this attached virtue to it. You're a better person if you declutter, which I think I agree with a lot of the time for myself. I feel better about myself. But do you think we could take it too far? Because maybe there is something about having all that stuff and someone you love passes away and you get to process by going through it. It's a bonding time with the family. You get to go through the old objects and photographs, and it's a special time. Even while it's difficult, is it part of the grieving process, and are we undercutting that part of it?
I think so. I think you can take anything too far. Both of my parents are gone, and I have children that are 7 and 9 and really don't know their grandparents. And sometimes I regret having gotten rid of so much of their stuff, because it is a tangible connection for them to their grandparents. I see that with some of the jewelry I had kept, or I kept my father had a Bucky Badger bank that I've given to my son, and he knows that that was grandpa's and it's his. So I would say don't take it too far, but try to think about something that's meaningful. And then if you do keep that item, say why it's meaningful. Was this your great-grandmother's item that she brought over? I know I have a cross stitch that is framed and in my home, and it's written in Swedish. I'm one quarter Swedish. Instead of having it stuffed in a drawer, it's framed in on the wall, and that's something that I can pass down to one of my children, and we know who it came from. We've had it translated. We know what it means. So picking out the things that mean something is wonderful, but it's lost when we just have heaps and heaps and piles and boxes in those, infamous Wisconsin basements.
So we're going to take one more call really quickly. Andy in Tomahawk. Hello, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what did you want to say?
I just think it's a good thing. I'm going through that with my father's possessions, and fortunately my mother's still alive, and there's 4 siblings plus myself. That's 5. And it is kind of a challenge. But so now for myself, I'm only 60, but I'm starting to purge, and I'm finding it very emotionally rewarding. I gave away our family sailboat 4 weeks ago to another family, and right now I'm in the process of driving up north and giving away a fishing boat to another friend so his daughter can enjoy it. And it's just nice to know that it's going to a good home and not in the dumpster.
Thank you so much for that call, Andy. So in like the last 30 seconds, Melinda, the karmic payback, the way you feel when you're actually able to give something away, do you think that that can help us along?
Oh, I do. I feel very fortunate. When my children were born, I had friends with older kids who just gave me tons and tons of clothing. I've hardly had to shop. And so I try to pass that on. When they're done with things, toys, books, clothes, I pass that on. I give it to a friend in need, or I give it to a charity. I post things on Craigslist for free at the curb. I want to keep things out of the waste bin and the dump if I can. So pass it on. Take control. You can make this decision and hopefully have a better outcome.
Thank you so much, Melinda. Melissa Gustafson-Gervasi is an attorney who focuses on estate planning and probate. Halloween, it's only a day away, and there is a debate brewing about a staple in the world of Halloween treats. It is, of course, candy corn.
That's right. The Wausau Daily Herald is picking up on the issue with the question, candy corn, tasty treat or do not eat at any cost? And JC, you and I talked. We are sharply divided on
this
one. We are
extremely
divided
on this. I, of
course, am on the side of truth and justice. Candy corn tastes bad. It tastes like wax.
I feel like you're on the side of monsters and, walking into paint. Like, candy corn is the best. Have you ever
That's the weirdest insult that anyone has ever lobbed at me.
It was the nicest insult I could think of on the air right now. I am extremely pro candy corn. I know we're going to probably get some calls saying, oh, I love candy corn or I hate candy corn. And it's going to be a Wisconsin divided.
Well, here's the thing. I really like it. We made my son a deep sea anglerfish cake for his birthday. And we used the candy corn for the snaggle teeth. And they were pretty cool for that. But no one wanted to eat them. I will tell you that. They were always stuck on the outside of the plate and the cake was eaten.
That is just a waste of candy corn, Veronica. Give me a break.
You seek out candy corn willingly of your own volition and you eat it?
Yeah. And I have a method of eating it. I eat it by the color. I'm very on board with candy corn.
I'm disturbed.
Well, fine.
Well, let us know what you think about candy corn on the Central Time Facebook page.